Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, believe it or not, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. And we go out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Somerset businessman Julian Parry is back to talk about the rolling referendum, his solution to corrupt party funding. Plus our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks, and much more this week from Jeff. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Julian Parry, a Somerset businessman. Julian, tell us a little bit about your business experience so we can know who you are.
Well, hello, and thank you for inviting me yet again. Business is now a very difficult area for an awful lot of people, and whilst the government are trying to tell us that business is getting better and it's all coming right, it's amazing how this is coming right just before election time. Do we believe it? Most people don't. They're too long in the tooth. We've seen too much of false promises from government before. And we realise also the terrible truth that so many things are being fixed behind the scenes that you can no longer rely on anything that government tells you. We don't have to throw our minds back very far, do we, to remember LIBOR, the rate being fixed, and the number of crimes that the banks have committed against society in general. The one that is my favourite is people who are now lending at up to 5,000%. And of course, this is a problem which has grown ever since Margaret Thatcher repealed the Moneylenders Act in 1984. That's when it all began. That's when it all began to go wrong. There is a major problem, and a lot of the real economic problems we have today were pre-planned, all for the benefit of the favoured few.
Now, Julian, I was listening to RTE, Irish Radio, this week in the morning, and they've had floods over in Cork, rather similar to the floods in the Somerset Levels, although not so bad as the Levels. And we had an EU commissioner on there saying, well, you know, yes, you can have your millions to sort out the flooding in Cork, because it's seen as a sort of sugar daddy, the European Union. Now, call me cynical if you want, but I wonder whether the political parties in this country are dragging us through the dirt in order to make the EU look like a rosy prospect, because the EU, of course, is completely unelected. I mean, the people who are running the European Commission, I mean, they've got the European Parliament, clearly, but they have very little power. The people with the real power that sit around the big table and spend the big money are the commissioners. None of them have been elected to those jobs.
Indeed so. Indeed, some of them, I remember Leon Britton is one, and our old friend, the Welsh windbag, was another, were actually unelected people who were now unelectable.
Well, that's right. Certainly Neil Kinnock, who you were mentioning there, and Chris Patten. He went on to become an EU commissioner after the good people of Bath chucked him out. He was actually, I believe, the chairman of the Conservative Party at the time, that he was deselected by in Bath back in the early 1990s. So his career took off after the democratic system kicked him out in 1992. He became a European commissioner and started spending even bigger amounts of money. So what do you think of my cynical turn of phrase saying, well, our politics nationally is being dragged through the dirt in order to make the EU look good?
Oh, I think it's spot on the mark. They are absolutely dreadful, and there is nothing worse than to look at the floods in Somerset at the moment and see Chris Smith, the so-called head of the Environment Agency, come down there after having given hollow promises a year before.
Well, I don't believe he has been down yet so far.
Well, he certainly came to see it. I saw him on television a few days ago, but they are appalling. The Levels have been flooded out and left flooded when there were flooding problems for 500 years. But when you have the drainage boards operating things, the people who ran it, the farmers, the local drainage boards, the councillors, they knew when to open the floodgates. They knew when the rains were coming. They knew what their particular patch of land would do. And they could say, well, open the floodgate there or open the floodgate
there.
Well,
if they try to now, Julian, they'll find those floodgates. I mean, we're talking about mainly the main way that these sorts of floodplains are managed is by sluices that take the drainage water out to sea and into the River Parrot, etc. You're a Western Superman, Western Supermare chap yourself, and you've up near you is the Huntsbill River. That's the most northerly big drain that comes out of the levels.
Yes.
That's near Huntsbill, just south of Weston. And I went down there and found that the sluice gate at mid tide, well, it's not, it would be fair, it wasn't actually low tide, but only, I mean, the river was very low, and so there was plenty of room for the Huntsbill River to be pouring out into the sea, was actually in its closed position, its summer position. And so it was holding back the water as much as it could. Now, despite that, the water was flowing over the top of the sluice gate. So if you imagine the sluice gate is actually down on its lowest setting to hold the water back, even though it could have been raised in order to let all this literally tons and tons a second of water out to sea.
Well, of course. But this raises the question, is that deliberate so that we're dragging Britain through the dirt so that the EU looks good, is it would be your argument, or is it because, as I believe, there is a massive problem with the Environment Agency because they are one of the most arrogant, ignorant, useless organisations I think I've ever had the misfortune
to deal
with.
So you've had dealings with these people, have you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I've beaten them in court. Some people I knew were being fined, where they were going to be fined and they were going to be prosecuted for tipping 3,000 tonnes of contaminated soil on a landfill site that was run by a local council. And somebody, they were seriously talking about taking them to court. And by the time I'd finished, the soil stayed where it was. The taxes which they'd been demanding were not only capped off and because it was restoration land and no taxes were payable under law, but we got £84,000 back from Her Majesty's government on taxes that had been paid in the meantime, and that included £7,500 in interest on it. And I had a call because I was dealing with something else where I'd exposed waste fraud in North Somerset, which is another scandal that got brushed under the carpet, costing everybody £1 million a year. And I was called up by one of the very, very senior people of the Customs and Excise on VAT. And I said, is that right? I'm told by one of your people that I'm the first guy in the Southwest to claim for interest on taxes returned. No, he said, that isn't right at all. You're the first bloke in the country to do it, and the Treasury isn't pleased. I said, well, the hell with them. But there is a real problem with these people. There's a real problem with mass centralised government in the hands of the few. You've seen it in the EU, 19 years now, without the auditors agreeing the books. That's every year they've been there. And what's been the latest response? They cut the auditors' budget. The whole thing is a criminal enterprise.
Well, it sounds very much like the City of London, which Rowan Bosworth Davies, the former Metropolitan Police officer for 12 years, and now a lecturer in London, has also said that the city actually is equivalent to an organised criminal enterprise by all the major international definitions of the mafia, organised crime. The city fits the bill. But you saying there 19 years it hasn't been audited, the accounts of the EU. Now, that is interesting because, you know, this week also the European Union has brought out a EU corruption report for the whole of the EU, a little map with different countries, some are red and some are green and various shades in between and orange. But the EU, is it got a bit of a cheek, hasn't it, doing a corruption report on the whole of Europe, country by country, without actually looking at its own corruption?
The words pot, kettle, black come to mind, frankly. They are a shocking crowd of people. They've usurped our democracy. They have stolen our freedoms. And they are becoming a clear and present danger to the rest of mankind. And the bankers are behind it. You remember the EU has got some very convenient little arrangements with America. America, as we know, are run by the all-seeing eye and the bankers at the back of Wall Street. And frankly, look at the state the world is in with the wars. They keep on fomenting war because of the military-industrial complex likes to make a lot of money out of seeing people kill each other. Are these people fit to walk the face of the earth? That's what we've got to ask. And why should we allow it? Well, you've got to allow it because you've got no choice, because they're in command, because they make the rules. Why do they make the rules? Because they have got all the seats in Parliament. Why have they got the seats in Parliament? Because the City of London is the one thing here in Britain that pays out the biggest amount of money towards the political parties for their election expenses. That's the problem. It all comes down to who's paying the piper, because who pays the piper calls the tune.
Now, it's lovely because we quite often hear these sorts of arguments, and it's very, very easy, isn't it, to look at all the sort of various systems in society, the things that are supposed to work for us, the bureaucracy. Some of it is necessary. But you've got something this week, Julian, haven't you, which is a solution. You've identified the funding of political parties as one of the key problems, where basically people are coming along from the city, mainly, other places too, and just buying legislation saying, well, we think that we should deregulate the water industry, for example. And within a few months' time and a few £1,000 in a few bank accounts, the water industry is deregulated. That's the way it works. People buy laws, essentially. So how do you propose to deal with it? It's a bit of a knotty one, but you've got some ideas, haven't you?
Well, a few years ago, Sir Christopher Kelly was reported on the party political funding.
So who is he?
Sir Christopher Kelly was the person appointed by the then Labour government, I think, to look into political party funding, because they'd just been caught with their hand in the cookie jar again, and it was a big embarrassment. And you know what happens. As soon as the politicians are embarrassed, they call for an inquiry, and they put somebody tame in there to come out with the answer they want to hear. But in this case, they got Sir Christopher Kelly to do it. And Sir Christopher Kelly, in fact, came out, and he reported that he believed that the party funding, the major political parties, should be funded from public funds. But of course, there are going to be two groups of people who are going to yell and scream about that. And they are going to be, one, the ordinary punter in the street, who's going to say, God, they take enough money, we don't want them controlling that as well.
Well, that's exactly what was going through my mind.
It's a very fair point, which is why I've invented what I have. And the other one, of course, is the City of London, who says, my God, we can't have the system changed, we'll lose our power, which sounds like a very good idea. So, given those two electorates, as you were, or constituencies, I don't think we need to worry about the City of London. We need to satisfy those who say, but we can't allow the politicians to take that over as well, and quite right too, which is why I have formulated the rules for the rolling referendum.
OK, the rolling referendum. Explain the basic principles first.
Well, there are about six principles to it, so bear with me, but here comes the science. For any political party to be publicly funded under this scheme, that party must have at least one elected member of Parliament. You can't throw it open everywhere, otherwise they'd all be on the bandwagon looking for money.
So, but what about a party, Julian, that, say, had put candidates up in, I don't know, 200-300 constituencies, not one in any of them, but overall got quite a good vote? So, for example, in the European election, they may well have got an MEP because it works on a different system. It's not first past the post, it's first past the post here. Other electoral systems might deliver several MPs, where the first past the post system we use for Westminster wouldn't deliver a single one.
You're quite right. There is a problem there. And of course, the highlight there is UKIP, because UKIP has got MEPs, but it doesn't have anybody in Parliament. On the other hand...
Well, it's got quite a few Conservatives who've got UKIP badges on, I think, haven't they?
Well... Or as the Hamiltons will say, you know, he was once a Tory, but now he's been going straight for 10 years. So the next thing is that we've got to address that problem, but there have to be rules, let me put it this way, that you can't just have everybody saying, I'm a political party and I want some public money. There's got to be a rule that makes sure it limits that. Let me move on. The party or parties in government and Her Majesty's loyal opposition will be allowed only public funding. Private funding will be expressly prohibited, whereas other parties could take both. And there's a reason for that, is because it's the government and Her Majesty's loyal opposition that actually make the rules. And if you denied private funding to the smaller parties, they wouldn't be able to grow as easily. So, and we want to spread the love, we want to spread the political field, as it were, so there are more people involved in politics, more people involved in the democracy, not less, which is where we're going with the present system and with the EU. Item three. Each year, the Electoral Commission will submit a proposal to Parliament for three levels of political funding. Rich, moderate, poor, whichever way you want to look at it. The funding scheme to be adopted in any given financial year would be chosen upon a free vote of all members of Parliament, and all members' names would be logged through the lobby and published so that everybody knew which member voted for which scheme. The Treasury would then hand out those funds to the Electoral Commission, taken from the general taxation coffers.
Okay, so now you're talking about how much the total amount would
That's
be?
That's the total amount. The total amount that Parliament has voted would be given to the Electoral Commission.
Well, why don't you just do it as a certain amount per MP?
No, because that's the point. That's the critical point. If you do that, you get it's a Buggins turns job, and we want to put a new dynamic into the whole arrangement so that it makes it really responsive, not to MPs' desires, but to the electorate's desires. Let me explain how. The Electoral Commission would now distribute those funds to the qualifying political parties. Where no preferences was expressed by individual voters, the funds will be distributed on the basis of votes cast, not seats obtained. However, it will be open to all registered voters at any time to advise the Electoral Commission of the party to which they wish their part of the funding to be allocated.
Hang on, this is getting complicated. But what you mean is that every single voter would have a kind of switch where they could switch their little bit of funding from one party to another party to another party, you know, several times maybe.
That's right.
So you might
do it only once every 3 months, but the fact, or you might aggregate it over every three months. But the whole thing about people being able to switch, after all, the taxman's got everybody on his database. The electoral roll has got everybody on their databases. With modern computers now, this is not a problem.
So I suppose, it is, isn't it? Because you're going to get rid of the idea of a secret ballot. So if you're voting for one party...
Oh, no, don't misunderstand me. We'll still have the secret ballot.
So you can vote for one party, but say that you want the funding to go to a different party.
Later on, yes, you could, for the simple reason that the party that comes in might come in full of promises and fail to deliver. And the way that you punish them is to take the money out of their bank account. Not only do you take the money out of their bank account, you give it to one of their rivals.
So it looks to me as if the most practical way of working this would be that when you vote once every 5 years, I mean, it used to be every four, I mean, they've stolen a year, haven't they?
Yes.
From us. By having this new fixed-term parliament thing. So yes. It's 5 years rather than the old 4 years. So they've stolen a year. But every time you have a general election, what you're saying is every single person that votes on that at that election, they would also be voting for funding for that particular party that they've elected a candidate for, as well as the candidate themselves. And what they're doing when they're voting is also saying that nobody else is allowed to fund that party, only the people that vote for it.
The only people who can fund the government and Her Majesty's loyal opposition are the public. They're not allowed to take private funding because private funding brings in the taint of corruption and the old prospect of he who pays the piper calls
the other interesting thing is, of course, is that would take away influence from big corporations because they cannot vote in a general election, so they wouldn't actually be able to vote money to those parties. Anyway, carry on through your points. I'm just trying to pin it down as you're going, Julian. So take us further into it.
Well, let's just stay with that point for a minute about the big corporations, because at the moment the big corporations have taken over the whole of democracy, and there's nobody going to be shedding any tears over them. And the very fact that the whole of the lobbying industry gets itself chopped off at the knees. What they're going to have to do is to persuade governments that what they want to do is actually good for the people, not just good for them. And that's the problem that we've got at the moment.
Well, we've got something called the lobbying bill going through at the moment, haven't we, through Parliament, which a lot of the charities like Oxfam, etc., have said is going to hit us. Now, this all started when we had several scandals to do with these big corporate communications companies like Bell Pottinger is an example, and they're called Strategic Communications. This is like public relations on steroids, massive international companies that will work for enormous multinational clients to bend the ear and twist the arms of government. Now, this was exposed 2 or 3 years ago, and around about actually the time of the general election. And so David Cameron said, I'm going to do something about lobbying. What's actually happened is that the Lib Dem Conservative Coalition have come up with a bill which actually hits charities, not these big corporate lobbyists. And a lot of the charities are now saying, people like Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace, people like this, are saying, hang on a minute, guys, you're hitting us, not the big boys. So, I mean, how is... this is why this kind of thing that you're coming up with is so important. I'll let you carry on now, Julian, because I interrupted you.
They are so cynical, and I agree with you about the bill. It's a problem. I wrote to my own MP the other day who voted for it, and I gave him a piece of my mind. But because they have to be reminded that it is the people who are in control of democracy.
So did you get a proper reply from him? Who is your MP?
It's John Penrose, MP. I don't vote for him, I've got to admit. I do harangue him on a weekly basis. The man needs to shape up and understand what his constituents need, not what he needs to give to his constituents for other reasons.
But this lobbying bill is going to become law now. The House of Lords have passed it, so that's it, really. It's going into law. So there has been a reaction to the criticism of lobbying, but I imagine not the sort of reaction that you would have preferred, Julian.
Well, no, quite, because, you know, the trouble is that they spot a problem, they say they're going to do something about it, and they come out with an Act of Parliament, which the architects of that Act of Parliament see as an opportunity to make the subject even worse. Well, and they'll hit somebody else.
Liz Hutchins, who's one of the senior campaigners at Friends of the Earth, said it was a bad day for anyone wanting to protect the environment, save a hospital, or oppose tuition fees. And that's in a Guardian article, Tuesday the 18th of January. The lobbying bill passes through the House of Lords. So this is a hot topic, but it looks as if it's been a disaster. The way the government have dealt with it has been a disaster. Anyway, Julian,
it was designed to be a disaster. And let me just remind listeners of the one great one where Tony Blair had, you weren't allowed to have a placard within a mile of, was it, of Parliament? Until the day the guy went there with just a placard with nothing on it and just walked around with a board on a pole. You know, great move. But let me carry on. So we've got this thing that the money is distributed on the number of votes cast, not on the number of seats obtained. That's important. What is even more important is that every voter has got a right to go online, go to the post office and get a form, to go to the Electoral Commission, and the very many means that we've got of doing these things these days, and simply say to them, this is my voter number, I now want my money to go to X party.
Will you have an absolute choice there? Will you be able to say, for example, I want my vote to go to a party that actually hasn't been elected yet? Make it go to a party that's got at least one MP?
At the moment, the way I'm looking at it at the moment is it will go to the parties that are in the scheme, that are in the funding scheme.
I wonder how that would work, for example, with the Sinn Féin MPs, because they don't take up their seats, do they?
Well, there will be a lot of anomalies, there will be a lot of critical points about it, and it's not a perfect world, we know that. But just because it's not a perfect world and somebody might get away with something over here and might get away with something over there is no reason to leave the stable door open or leave the gate open and let the whole herd go. We've got to do something about bringing MPs, bringing our electorate, our elected representative, bringing them to heel so they do what the public want, not what they want to do for their well-heeled friends who are paying them loads of cash.
Yeah, well,
there is a problem.
I was listening to some coverage on Radio 5 Live this week of the subject of people being disillusioned with politics and not voting. And the way they introduced it, I was actually really annoyed to hear was, well, these people in living in poor areas in London, maybe they, if they don't vote, maybe they won't be represented in government. Think about the way that they said that. Because the reason they don't vote is because they are not represented in government. They don't feel their vote counts. It's not just that they don't feel it. It doesn't seem to count for them. So, you know, the thing is to make sure that the system is reacting to what people really want on the outside, rather than Westminster is seen to be a bunch of people living in ivory towers working for international big business.
That's exactly what they are, and it's an absolute disgrace. And all these people who don't vote at the moment have decided that they're going to say, enough of it, I'm turning away. The next thing that they will do is they will pick up the pitchfork and come marching down the street. So it might be a good idea if the politicians were to see people turning away from the ballot box as a warning of what might else like to come that nobody wants to see. Let me continue. So we've got this point over that everybody can change their mind. The ballot still stays secret. Who they're funding stays secret. So there's no problem over that. But it doesn't mean to say that who you voted for is necessarily getting your vote by the time that parliament is over. And that may happen a lot more quickly than you think. Because the Electoral Commission will report on the state of the party funding once a month. The report will be sent directly to the Queen and be published in leading newspapers and media, as well as the London Gazette.
Will the Queen read it?
I'm sure she will. Oh, I'm sure she will. Avidly, I would have thought. Absolutely avidly. I sent some stuff up to the palace last week. I had a letter back within 7 days. And she had taken the papers. There were 100 pages in the report. That was sent to the Cabinet Office. And I think somebody won't be getting his MBE. We will see. But don't think that the palace doesn't look. Don't think that the Queen doesn't care. And don't think that she won't do something about it. She does. I've got the proof. So let's now move on. The Electoral Commission will report to the Queen, and the report will highlight the transfer of funds dictated by public request and also broadly report the reasons given on forms or online for the request.
So you'll get a bit of a report every once in a while saying what's going on.
When you would be reporting to the Electoral Commission and saying, I want my money to go to there, there will be a space for you, not obligatory, but the opportunity for you to say in there exactly what you weren't happy with and exactly why you were shifting the money. I mean, to say, if this had been in Tony Blair's time, you know, you would have been able to say, we don't want to go fight in Afghanistan, or we don't want to go into Syria. You know, we don't want another war, Mr. Blair, you know, which he decided he'd do on words of mass deception with a twinkle in his eye, as one bureaucrat put it. So it's important that not only do you shift the money, but you tell them why. And now the last thing is, and this is the one I really love. If at any time the government party arrives at a point where it is in receipt of, say, less than 15% of the total political pot voted by Parliament in any year, then the Electoral Commission would be required to report to Her Majesty that the government had lost the popular mandate it had achieved at the last election. Under the new constitutional rules, it would then be open to Her Majesty to consider whether or not it would be appropriate to dissolve Parliament so that new elections could be called.
Well, I mean, that's not democratic, though, is it? Leaving it to the Queen to make that decision?
Surely,
if it goes down to a certain level, surely that should automatically trigger an election?
No. There could be spikes there. It is a report to the Queen. We are a constitutional monarchy. The Queen has been there a very long time. She has I'm sure she has the sort of goodwill of the country at heart. She, as the Crown, provides tremendous continuity of rule, and I think it's important that Her Majesty would be given the choice. Obviously, if they reported 2 or 3 months in a row that this wasn't coming back, then she would be entitled to do what I'm going to say now, which is to call Black Rod to go down to the house, put his gaiters on, and smack on the door 3 times and tell them that they better be prepared to take their pension funds and find another job. The point is that we cannot go on with this two-party game where people just are, you've got Hobson's choice, you can have Labour.
Well, we've got a three-party game, haven't we? Not a two-party game.
Well, you might shortly have a four-party game, who knows? But the fact of the matter is that there is, without a shadow of a doubt, there is a huge democratic deficit. That deficit must be addressed. The rolling referendum is my suggestion for doing it. If anybody can genuinely come up with a better scheme, I'd love to hear it, but I haven't heard one yet. And what I will tell you is that everybody I try this one on, once they've grasped it, in one go, then I haven't found anybody yet who said they wouldn't vote for it.
Well, I think that's the proof will be in the pudding if you can manage to get some people to take up the idea. Because at the end of the day, money is actually what it's all about, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the reasons why the City of London seems to rule the country rather than Parliament, is because Parliament is constantly having to go cap in hand to the bankers to borrow money in order to keep services going in Britain. So it's actually it's he who pays the piper calls the tune. You said that right at the start. These are the people who are running things because they are calling the tune, the bankers.
Yeah, but, you know, there you've got to look at the difference between a banker and an ordinary person. What is the difference between a banker and an ordinary Joe Bloggs? A banker has got a printing press in his basement and he prints money. That's the difference. And it is high time.
That sounds like fraud to me.
Well, that's exactly what Senator Ron Paul called it.
Counterfeiting, you know, isn't it?
That's what he called it. He called the Federal Reserve the greatest counterfeiting operation in history. If you look at any of the policies and the theory of fiat currency, it is a question of just printing money. So if you're going to print money, why do you allow private bankers to do it? Why doesn't the state do it and hand out the money? You know, one way you could do it is to print enough money every year to cope with the whole of the economic output of the country, divided by something that is called the multiplier. I won't try and explain that. Now I'm sure there are plenty of economists out there who will understand what I mean, but there is a way of calculating these things so that you wouldn't get inflation, but that there would be money for everybody to enjoy their lives without being absolutely crippled and put to the rack on mortgages for overpriced properties, all of which have been deliberately built up by Blair and the bankers from 1997. In fact, if you look at it, folks, you look up on the internet, you look up the housing index, all right? Look up the housing index issued by the Her Majesty's government through the land registry. And if you look at the graph on that, you will see that they restarted it at a level of 100 in 1995. By about 2001, it had gone to about 150, probably not much over 100 by the time Blair came in 1997. By 2008, it had reached nearly 400, and then it fell back by 25% or about 300 in between 2008 and 2009. It jumped up 30 points to about 330. I'm talking Cornwall numbers now, by the way, folks, in 2010. And then it flatlined. Now it's beginning to kick up again, but it flatlined. And the whole thing about, you see the press talking about house prices going up and isn't this good? No, it's not good. It's not good for the next generation. It is a disaster for them, and it is enslaving them all to paying interest to bankers who never earned a real red cent in their lives.
Now, you just mentioned printing money. We call that something else nowadays, don't we?
We call it quantitative easing.
QE, quantitative easing.
It's actually counterfeiting. It will cause massive inflation, although there are those who said so much money was lost before the last crisis.
But it isn't causing big, massive amount.
No, because there was so much was actually written off the books last time out that they're still filling the hole. But they're filling it with printed money. They're not filling it with the wealth that has been genuinely created by the sweat of people's brow. But what they do here now is the money that is printed, it comes off a printing press without any work ethic behind it, but the interest that is paid, that comes out of the real wealth, and the bankers are screwing everybody. And that is another area of life where we need to completely change the financial system, because we can't go on.
These banks are nationalised, aren't they? Lloyds is, NatWest is, RBS is.
They've all been modelled, whoever owns them for the moment, they have all been modelled on a particular idea of interest payments. And the point is that as soon as you look at the world today, you realise that the West is failing. We are going to be ending up with, instead of 80% of the resources coming in here, I think a report the other day said shortly we'll be ending up with 35% of the resources. There is real poverty coming, born of real inflation. There is a major problem coming, and the people behind that have been the bankers who thought that they could create a new situation in which they owned everything, and they were going to make sure the rules were paid off, were created by politicians who they had paid off lock, stock and barrel. It is time something was done to correct the balance.
Okay, Julian Parry, and I'll just give listeners a reference online if people want to go and have a look at more about the rolling referendum. Someone called Dr. Matthew Ashton, A-S-H-T-O-N. His politics blog has got a whole page about it. Never mind AV. What the world needs is RR, the rolling referendum, and there's more details on there. But explaining it for us just then was Julian Parry. Thanks very much for joining us, Julian.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined by Ed Lander now. Hi, Ed, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thanks, Dane.
Now, you work in some pretty high-tech industry, which is to do with microchips. Tell us, first of all, how did you get into such a world?
It's almost by accident, actually. When I was growing up, I was a big fan of computer games. I always thought I'd fall into computer game design. Then I had a go at programming at school, realised it's not really my kind of thing, prefer something a bit more tangible, something a bit more tactile. So I went towards electronics. Then at university, I studied electrical and electronic engineering.
That's here in Bristol, is it?
Absolutely. I actually got quite a passion for microelectronic design. Was slightly disappointed to find out that involves programming, but it is a fascinating complicated.
Hang on, so the design of a chip, you have to actually program that.
Absolutely.
As well?
Yeah, it's quite a surprise to a lot of people, but it's code.
Okay, so what sort of ingredients are there in the chip that you have to make work together? I mean, it must be an enormously complicated thing. It's like a giant, great printed circuit, isn't it? Really?
It's a huge, yeah. We call them, you know, puzzles. Some people talk about bolting things together like Lego, but I think that's trivializing something that is incredibly tricky. But yeah, as I said, the starting point is people writing code, hardware description.
So you're saying essentially that you don't actually design the chip; you tell a program to do the designing for you. Is that right?
I wish that it was that simple. But these programs that we use, which are incredibly expensive and are developed by hundreds and hundreds of people, they need a lot of instruction. They need a lot of guidance. But you do buy in code from other companies, and then you push it through what are called flows, where you translate programming language into something that's connectivity gates, logic gates that people are more familiar with. Ultimately, that gets rooted, laid out, and is translated into something that's sent to a fabrication plant that is essentially the microchip design. It's a bunch of optical reticles where the whacking machines.
On. What is an optical reticle? Please explain.
There's a lot of jargon.
Yeah.
The way that I'm not an expert on the actual fabrication, but my understanding is that in those plants themselves, they're using special machines that do ion doping on the silicon wafers, and they have to use these optical masks to control where that happens, and layer by layer they build up the design. It's literally layers. It's not
okay. Now you say optical. Am I right in saying that actually what's happening is a kind of photographic process?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's a nice way to simplify that.
So you're almost printing a photo of the microchip that you want.
I like that one. That's a very nice analogy. Thank you for simplifying that for the audience.
Yeah, it sounds amazing, really. Okay, so how big are these things? If you were to blow them up so you could actually see them, I mean, they're minuscule. They're tiny, weeny little things.
It's incredible the complexity of a fairly ordinary microchip, like one in a mobile phone. The order of magnitude of transistors on there is phenomenal. I don't have these numbers off the top of my head, but typically microchips they're about 10 mil by 10 mil, and they go inside a plastic package, so they look a bit larger. These devices have got all kinds of pre-designed blocks in them, like video encoders, decoders, audio decoders, security blocks, things that talk to the outside of the chip, things that allow you to debug the chip if it doesn't work properly.
Now, also, when you're doing the design of these things, this is quite an amazing, fascinating area. I mean, do they actually run a design, say, well, let's just make a few of these things and see if it actually works? I mean, there must be just a bit of trial and error involved as well.
Perhaps it might have been that way in the past. The industry is incredibly competitive, and these mask sets that I was talking about, these optical mask sets, those cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if you're a small company, that could bankrupt you if you send a design to a fab and it comes back and it doesn't work. So what we do is simulation. So you use computers to simulate that code.
Ah, right. So you're actually using a computer to actually pretend to be the chip.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. And you can even use what are called hardware accelerators to do even faster, more powerful things and run software on them. So it's very rigorous. You make sure that this thing will work, not just functionally, but that the actual silicon will work in terms of noise and other characteristics.
Now, I mean, certainly when I was younger, I'm talking about the 1970s, there was a lot of talk about IT is going to do amazing things, the internet is going to, I mean, this is even before, apparently, Tim Berners-Lee supposedly invented it. I mean, I can remember chatting about the internet years ago, but this is supposed to make life a lot easier for us. I don't always think it does. You know, what are your thoughts of someone?
It makes us more productive, Tony, and therefore we can work harder and we can socialise harder and we can never have any time to ourselves.
But we don't seem to have as much leisure time as we did in the 1970s. Surely the chip should be mechanising things for us, doing all those annoying tasks that take too much time, telling our washing machine when to turn and when to not turn. But we don't have more leisure time. We have less leisure time for some reason. Yeah. Why is that?
I think maybe we're creatures of habit, and that we always seem to fill time. And as you say, the revolution of the washing machine and the washer dryer and so on, and has allowed us to find more time. And now we fill it with social media and television, and we're constantly distracted, and we're constantly stimulated. And I think a lot of people don't even know how to switch off or unplug, and quite frankly, that the idea terrifies them.
Well, they don't get the chance, maybe. I mean, I'm also wondering as well, with the complexity of the chips becoming bigger and bigger, what are your thoughts about artificial intelligence? Are these things going to start thinking for us, or is someone going to program them to tell us what to think?
I think it's still in the realms of blue sky. I believe Google acquired a company recently who claimed to have an idea of how to make adaptive hardware. At the moment, it's all pre-programmed things that start dumb and learn already pre-decided things, but I don't think we have to worry about Skynet just yet.
What's Skynet?
From Terminator,
infamous
self-aware.
The only thing we need to really worry about is a sort of little vacuum cleaner thing that slowly learns its way around the room, where it might bump up against a door or something. So that's the kind of state that artificial intelligence is at, really.
I think it's beyond there in the realms of research. I think people talk about the cloud a lot, and it's a big buzz phrase. But the amount of compute power that's now out there does open doors for some quite amazing research that allows people to trial these things. And I think there is hardware out there that would be able to have some randomness built into it by the very nature of how we design microchips. You try and prevent randomness, but you can deliberately inject randomness, and that way something will behave differently. You can have designs that evolve, that blow fuses that would change the behavior of a microchip.
But they learn by getting things wrong, basically.
Again, it would be up. It'd be up to the software and the hardware that's on there. You could really have something that would just go.
It sounds to me what you're saying is it's only as intelligent as the person that's actually doing the programming and telling it what to do.
I think in the past that was definitely the case, but I think there are opportunities to let something be creative. But at the same time, I'm not sure if it would ever be useful.
Okay, fascinating, Ed Lander, Bristol University graduate working here now in Bristol. Thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, Tony. Thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
One thing must stop if our government is to regain our respect and that of the rest of the world, and that is state-sanctioned torture. By keeping torture secret, the US and British government think they can get away with it. But even with the recent revelations about extraordinary rendition, they've proved why the government culprits haven't yet been jailed, that they can get away with it. Whistleblowers cause massive problems for these criminals, though, and a great example from the 1980s is the former CIA case officer John Stockwell. He's the highest-ranking CIA officer ever to blow the whistle. And here he is, speaking on Alternative News magazine back in the 1980s.
A lot of people have been involved with the CIA over the years. Alternative Views News Magazine. With us tonight, John Stockwell, the former CIA case officer who's back for an encore performance. We're going tonight to discuss the On Company Business, the documentary film that has been made recently about the CIA.
There are some people who've said that the film was biased against the CIA because Colby and Helms look like such hard people. And that it was therefore the filmmaker was trying to catch the pro-CIA people in order to make them look harsh and hard. And of course that's nonsense. These gentlemen are in fact very hard individuals who were running an organization that was into some very heavy stuff.
He basically lets those people damn themselves with their own words.
Exactly.
I mean, he has has a film clip of George Meany denying that they got any money from the CIA, and then in the next segment he documents how they did get money from the CIA.
I say to you categorically now that it is not true. Well, under no circumstances have we ever received or solicited any money from the CIA.
It doesn't say that the AFL-CIO received it. Well, $33 million doesn't go to the AFL-CIO. It goes to the AIFLD.
Well, let me state that these unions you mentioned have stated just as categorically as I have that they do not receive and have not received CIA money.
The CIA's trade union operations are effected through a vast bureaucracy of people. These are the officers of the international trade unions and of the national unions, especially in the United States, through which the CIA is able to infiltrate and manipulate the international unions. Of course, Mr. Meany has been in the past one of the principal, if not the principal, U.S. trade unionist through which these operations are affected.
I'm Andy McClellan. I'm the inter-American representative of the AFL-CIO and have been since 1964. Prior to that time, I was the associate inter-American representative. And prior to that time, I was inter-American representative of the International Union of Food and Allied Workers, based in Geneva, but working in Latin America.
I'm the executive director of the American Institute for Free Labor Development, prior to that time. As a matter of fact, I've been the executive director now for some 10 years, and I've been with the American Institute for Free Labor Development since its founding in 1962. For the period immediately prior to 1962, I was the Inter-American Representative of the Postal Telegraph and Telephone International, which has headquarters in Switzerland, but I was their representative in the Western Hemisphere.
There have been some people who have accused the AFL-CIO of collaborating with the CIA, and what would be your response to that accusation?
I think that is so ridiculous and so infantile, so juvenile, to make such an accusation.
And you, Mr. Doherty?
Well, I agree. I don't know of any labor leader that wouldn't out-and-out deny such an accusation. It's just not true.
In Latin America, one of the principal and most effective of the trade unionists, of the American trade unionists who worked with us, was Bill Doherty. He had originally started in the Post Telegraph and Telephone Workers International, coming up through the Communications Workers of America. Later on, he was transferred into the American Institute for Free Labor Development. This was set up during the Kennedy period and is a joint effort by American trade unionists like George Meany and the heads of American-based multinational corporations which operate in Latin America.
Order is restored, but not before 11 persons are killed and a crippling general strike is called over the power struggle between the president and the parliament of Brazil.
Says Mr. Doherty, quote, "What happened in Brazil on April 1st did not just happen. It was planned, and planned months in advance. Many of the trade union leaders, some of whom were actually trained in our institute, were involved in the revolution and in the overthrow of the Goulart regime."
Immediately prior to the military takeover in Brazil, there was a group of students from Brazilian unions in training in Front Royal. This wasn't the first of the Brazilian groups that have been here, nor has it been the last. We've had them continuously. They weren't in any kind of a course training for revolutionary activities or clandestine activities. They were in a regular collective bargaining course. It so happens that when many of those students went back home from that course, their unions were involved in this struggle against the attempt of the communists to take over some of the unions, and that's precisely what I meant by the statement.
One aspect of the film is that's I think very important is it has no narration. That it doesn't tell you what to think about what you're seeing. What it does is it was an incredible research job and all these interviews with people from various points of view. It lets those people tell the story and exposes what the public record is, and then lets you draw your own conclusions.
And it shows the cause and effect. For instance, it will take a look at CIA torture schools held in the United States.
The police program began on a large scale under Dwight Eisenhower. He felt there was a need to train the police to help with the fighting of communism after the Second World War. He recruited for the purpose a man named Byron Engel. Byron Engel was, by the time he came into this program, a member of the CIA.
So the only way they get their information is through torture.
Whenever one could get the information about a specific high-ranking official in torture, not one of these men off the street, but a man who had based his career on his ability to extract information from political prisoners.
Former CIA case officer John Stockwell there relating his experiences of working within the US intelligence services. Sounds like they picked up pretty much where the Nazis left off, doesn't it? And more from John in future weeks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And apologies, we don't have Jeff, I'm afraid, with the What's On Guide this week. He's phoned in to say that the train was cancelled into Lawrence Hill here, where we're based at the City Academy here in Bristol. So we'll have Jeff and his report on the movements of the Bristol City Council, which Jeff is not too happy with, to open a Thomas Chatterton Centre next week. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, that's Ed Lander and Julian Parry, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and you'll find them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Everybody wants to be famous, nobody wants to be nameless, aimless. People act shameless, trying to live like entertainers. Want to fly crib with the anchor, send the spare money that they ain't made yet. Got a brand on tick that they ain't paid yet. Spend a paycheck in the West End on the weekend. Got no money by the end of the weekend. But they don't care because their life is a movie. Starring Louis V, paid for by yours truly. Truthfully, it's a joke like a bad episode of Hollyoaks. Can't keep up with the governor, so they got bad credit. Living on direct, they be in debt. They still don't get it because they're too busy living the high life. The nightlife hugging the highway, living large and it all says.
Sometimes it seems the sun is just too wrong. And things are wrong no matter what I do.
That's right.
Now and then it seems like life is just too much. But you got the love I need to see me through.
Check it, yo. Let me take you down to London City where the attitude's bad, don't know whether it is. Everybody's on the paper chase, just one big frat race. Everybody's got a screw face, so many two-faced. Checking the hat, they said they're ready to ride. I'm on the inside, looking at the... Someone's an accurate reflection, city-wide, north, east, west, and the south side. Everywhere I go, there's a rune on the corner. Got a search, I'm gonna stay like a sauna. And it's getting warmer, and now I'm water. So the voice struck me a bubble to a warner. Mr. Politician, can you tell me the solution? What's the answer? What's the conclusion? Is it an illusion? Is it I'm a branch? I see you understand, because they're trying to live large and it all say.
Sometimes I feel like my head's up in the air.
Everybody's in the clutch, yeah, I'll make it rain. But not for famine, just for the sake of having 15 minutes of fame, and everywhere's the same. Hanging in the game, I see the same thing. Everybody acting like they're plain sailing. But I see rough seas ahead, living in recession and in a depression, in whatever profession. It's in my confession, I'm caught front, I'm in the forefront. Living for money, ready to start like a bungee jump. With no rope, but I ain't trying to see the bottom, because that's where I came from, I have forgotten.
You got the love.
Who's got the love?